This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country.
That's President Lyndon Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act into law on July 2nd, 1964. That law banned public and workplace discrimination because of race or because of national origin or because of religion. It also banned discrimination because of sex, and that last-minute addition to the bill was largely thanks to a segregationist Virginia congressman named Howard Smith. Now, Howard Smith added the ban on sex discrimination to what is now known as Title VII of the law. Some historians think Smith's addition was actually a joke. He was pretty sarcastic about it at the time. Others say he was worried about white women losing jobs to blacks who would have new access to the workplace. But whatever his reasons, Title VII and those three words in it, because of sex, have transformed the role of women in the workplace over the last 50-plus years in this country. Author Jillian Thomas chronicles that change in her new book out today. It's called Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases in 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. Author Jillian Thomas chronicles that change in her new book out today. It's called Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases in 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. And she says that early on, the statute faced real barriers, mostly from federal officials who were supposed to be enforcing it.
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which was the agency created by Title VII to enforce the statute, really didn't take it seriously. There are quotes of some of the initial leaders of the agency referring to it as a fluke that was born out of wedlock. One of them was at a press conference and was asked, "What about sex?" And he said, "I'm all for it." So it was definitely considered a joke for a good period of time. Eventually, a cadre of very dedicated, mostly women lawyers within the EEOC brought it around, and it became a very powerful force and remains a powerful force.
So it started out, as the law often does, with a lot of abstractions. But what this book chronicles really is how that abstraction is transformed into real life. You have a character named Ida Phillips. She's a waitress in Florida trying to get a job at a big weapons factory. Tell her story.
Ida Phillips was a mother of seven children and was married, but it was an unhappy marriage, and her husband was not, to say the least, a contributor to the family. So she worked as a waitress, but she heard from her next-door neighbor that they were hiring down at the assembly line at Martin Marietta, the defense contractor, and that the wages would be vastly greater than what she was making as a waitress and also came with benefits. So she drove down. There was an ad in the paper, and she drove down, and the receptionist wouldn't even hand her an application because she first asked Ms. Phillips, "Do you have any children who are preschool age?" And Ms. Phillips did have a five-year-old daughter, her youngest, Gracie. And so she answered that she did. And the receptionist wouldn't even give her an application because she said the company won't hire women with children that young. They'll hire men, but not women. And so she came home and she sat down at her kitchen table and wrote a letter to Lyndon Johnson. And that letter to Lyndon B. Johnson ended up getting forwarded to the EEOC, which is the start of the filing process for a federal lawsuit. She teamed up with an African-American lawyer, very young, just out of law school, named Reese Marshall. They lost at the district court level and appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit endorsed the company's assumption that underlay its policy, which is that, well, of course, mothers are going to be less dependable workers, and we don't think Congress intended to undermine that assumption or not let employers make that assumption. Finally, Reese Marshall was able to get some prominent national groups involved in the case, which he had not been able to up until that time. And the NAACP Legal Defense Fund was able to see that even though Ida Phillips was a white woman, that it was mostly black women who were mothers and in the workforce, and that this policy very directly affected the population they cared about most.
Well, Ida Phillips won in the Supreme Court and instantly became something of a pioneer of these sex discrimination cases. But Jillian Thomas, in the end, what did she get for her victory?
She got very little, which is sadly the case so often. The company did eventually agree to settle, and after the Supreme Court victory, because the company was able to produce evidence showing that if she had been hired way back when she first applied, that her position would have suffered a layoff. So all told, I think she got something around $15,000, and she gave some of it to her oldest daughter to buy a house. She took Gracie, the cause of the whole lawsuit, took her to Disney World, and then she bought herself an air conditioner, which was the first one she'd ever had all her years living in Florida.
Well, there were no women on the court when this case was decided, of course, and reading through the book, it made me wonder how the profile of these cases have changed over the last couple of decades as women slowly started to join the court and help crafting the decisions. How have these cases changed since that era began?
You're absolutely right. I mean, at the time Title VII was enacted, there were almost no women on the federal bench across the country, let alone on the Supreme Court. Sandra Day O'Connor was on the court when the first sexual harassment case came to the court, and it's obvious from the questioning that she did from the bench that she knew something about this issue that the men on that court did not know. And that certainly has proceeded. In the more recent cases, the court has been rather tough on Title VII plaintiffs, and we've, as a result, seen a number of very impassioned dissents from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, especially.
So you mentioned that Title VII cases have had some setbacks in front of the court in the last several years. Is there a way to describe what the ceiling or the limits of Title VII have become now in the interpretation of just how much women can ask for in terms of equal treatment under the law?
Well, I will say, as a caveat to my prior point, the one area in which Title VII cases have really been expansively read by the court is in the area of retaliation. And one of the cases in the book, the Burlington Northern case, was decided in 2006, and it was the first time the court had addressed retaliation. And since that time, they have been extremely expansive in protections for people who complain about discrimination or help their colleagues complain about discrimination. But the other changes that I've seen in the area of sexual harassment, for instance, the law has developed in such a way that the judicial inquiry is much more focused on how did the victim of the harassment react? Did she make it obvious and openly understood that she did not welcome it? There's this standard of having to show that it was unwelcome harassment. And then she has to show that she utilized every possible mechanism for complaining. Those are obviously common sense notions that if someone's harassing you, you should do your best to make it stop. But the way this is played out in the courts is that it ends up being rather punitive, and a lot of the focus of the analysis is not on what the harassment was or what the employer did to try to stop it, but what the victim did to try to stop it herself.
Jillian Thomas is author of Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases in 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. Jillian Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.